Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz. Episode 145 for December 15th, 2010. John O'Bacon and Severed Fifth. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, libre, open-source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at Stonehenge.com, bringing to you every week, or as often as we can get to it, a show about open-source software. Today's show is a little special. For one, for those of you that are trying to watch this as a video, there's not a video form for this one. We're just doing an audio for reasons I'll explain in a moment. For two, I don't have a co-host this week. I hope you'll forgive that based on who the guest actually is. A former co-host, our one and only, John O'Bacon. Yes, in fact, we are getting the band back together, almost literally, because today we're going to be talking about John O'Bacon's Severed Fifth Project, which is a project to really put his money where his mouth is on open source music, as well as the whole open source movement. So I hope you'll enjoy this particular show. Before I actually get to the interview, a little bit of a programming note for those of you that were expecting the previous show to be, or even this show, I guess, to be the show about OpenPilot UAVs. We had a preemption by Leo Laporte himself attending and presenting at Loeb. Sorry about that, but they occupied our live recording time, and I made the decision about midway through that we probably should just go ahead and roll these guys over. That'd be a bad thing to do to a plane, but I mean roll it over in the calendar. So they're actually scheduled now for January 12th. We will be bringing them back. I saw some of the preview material. I am really excited about this upcoming show. Aaron Newcomb will, in fact, also join us as the co-host, as already planned. You may have noticed a slight gap in the schedule as you're listening to this, most likely, if you listen to it almost immediately in the feed, as I often do to my podcasts. I am now out on a cruise ship somewhere in the Western Caribbean with Sky and Telescope magazine. We have a program that's looking at astronomy, in particular the lunar eclipse that's happening probably right about now. It depends on what time of day I guess you're listening to this, but wonderful show. So there'll be another gap next week because, again, I am not in a position where I can record a live show, and I didn't bank up any pre-recorded shows as I try to do from time to time. So that's a little programming note for you, but that's not why you're listening. You're listening to hear the content of today's show. This is a really, really cool show. I've been calling this the very special holiday edition of Floss Weekly, and I will just go ahead and get right into the interview. Let's go ahead and bring Jono on. So hello, Jono.
Hello.
Hey, good to talk to you again. You know, I've got to say, you know, the Floss Weekly listeners are very loyal, and they're very loyal to you, because there's not a week that goes by when someone doesn't say, when are you going to bring Jono back? When are you going to bring Jono back? Just wanted to let you know that you're well missed, very missed.
Deranged individuals that they are.
Yes, and I have to say that, you know, you had provided for many of those shows an aspect of the whatever we were talking about that I really just didn't have. So that was really nice, too, because I don't know much about Linux, and apparently you know a little bit more than I do about Linux, so that really helped.
Not much. Marginal information. Everything I read is in the back of a cereal box, you know.
So. Yeah. Well, what's been keeping you busy since you've been away from our show?
Well, yeah, things have been pretty hectic, and particularly with Severed Fifth. You know, I mean, I've been busy with work and busy with other stuff, but Severed Fifth is my new big project, and it's really progressing at one hell of a pace, so I'm really pleased with it.
Well, let's go ahead and talk about that. So what is Severed Fifth?
So Severed Fifth is basically a music project that I set up a little while back. The basic background of it is that a few years ago I was hearing lots of blatherings in the press about how Nine Inch Nails and Radiohead were experimenting with Creative Commons licensing for their music and how this was the new music industry. Mm-hmm. And being the cynical arsehole that I am, because I'm English and that's how we roll. I basically, the first thing that struck me was, well, hang on a second, Nine Inch Nails and Radiohead, they have their reputations forged from the traditional music industry where you sign a record deal and you sign your distribution rights to a label and, you know, they market it and then hopefully you're successful. Mm-hmm. it didn't really tell me anything about regular bands. And I've been playing in metal bands since I was 16. And, you know, I was, you know, with the bands that I've been in, you know, you spend a lot of time playing shows and you play with lots of support bands. I mean, most metal shows will have four or five bands on. Mm-hmm. And it didn't tell me whether the Creative Commons free culture music industry is good for those bands. Is it good for bands who aren't, who don't have a reputation from the previous music industry?
So in other words, you're saying that it's okay for somebody like Radiohead to do it because they've already been established, so they can afford to give away some stuff for free to kind of really simplify the argument.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you're a millionaire, it's easy to be generous, essentially. Yeah. And, you know, that was kind of the analogy I was thinking about. Mm-hmm. So it didn't really tell me. And so my thinking was, well, wouldn't it be cool to have a bit of an experiment and to see how far a band could push it under the Creative Commons licensing way of doing things, mm-hmm. Who isn't well known. Around that time, I was moving to the US, and this was back in 2008. So I set up Severed Fifth as you know, and announced it as a project to basically see how far an individual musician can take music. And I did it myself because, you know, I was moving countries, so I didn't have a band and all the rest of it yet. In fact, I just because I was moving countries, I was wrapping up my previous band in England, Seraphidium. So I basically wrote an album called Denied by Rain, put it out there. And it was a pretty intense, brutal death metal album. I mean, it was mm-hmm. there's a lot of grunting and growling and bashing of pots and pans in that album. And but I moved to the US, and you know, I recorded the album. I put it out there under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike license. Some people seemed to enjoy it, but I didn't really have a lot of time to really push the band. Mm-hmm. So I moved over here, and everything was, you know, was going well. I got married, started settling into my new Californian lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And a couple of years passed, and you know, I got busy with things like writing a book, and you know, things have been really busy at work and all the rest of it. And then I started feeling the itch to really resurrect Severed Fifth and do it right. You know, to get an album together, to put together a live band, to get out and play some shows, and to really do it well. And the other thing was that the music changed as well. You know, the first album, like I said, was a really pretty brutal death metal album. I started working on new material, which is much more accessible. It's, you know, instead of growling all the way through it, I sing and growl in parts, and it sounds like a mix of Iron Maiden and Megadeth. You know, is this the kind of style we're going for? Mm-hmm. So I started writing an album, and I was pretty much about most of the way through it, and I was actually flying back from a trip to New York, and I was in Detroit Airport, and I met up with this guy called Chris Contos, who used to play in a big metal band called Machine Head. He plays in a band called Attitude Adjustment. He's played in a bunch of other bands as well, like Testament and Conqueror. Mm-hmm. And so this guy's an idol of mine. You know, I met my idol in an airport. In fact, I learned to play drums really from listening to him. And I told him about, you know, Severed Fifth, and I'd written this album, but I'd not recorded it yet, and the whole ethos surrounding free culture and the new music industry and all the rest of it, and he was just stoked about it, and he put me in touch with some other musicians, and it really started going from there.
Now, does that, when he was getting excited by it, is this something that he had considered already, or were you able in a short conversation to able to sell the idea of what really you're trying to do?
I'd really got this elevator pitch down, because I've been thinking about this. I mean, when I was originally thinking about it back in 2008, mm-hmm. my initial hunch was basically, you know what? Music should be free, because I was basing it essentially on the open source way of doing things. You know, if you give software away for free, then it allows people to share it, and if you can share it, it means that more people have access to it, and you know, it brings the content provider and the content consumer closer together. So for me, back in 2008, it was all about giving music away for free, but I'd spent a couple of years stewing on this and thinking about it, and it made me realize that that giving the music away for free is one tiny component. So let me outline the problem and
sure.
where I think the solution is, and then you can all wake up again. So basically, the way the music industry traditionally works is you're in a band, you get together a band, you put some music together, you go out and play a load of shows, and then you hope that somebody's going to see you. An A&R person from a record label and take interest in you, or you record an album and you approach a record label. What happens is you then create a product, a record, and you sign your distribution rights to the label. So the label basically have control over where it's distributed. If they, you know, you can't necessarily distribute it yourself. They are basically in charge. Now, then what they then do is they then invest a certain amount of money into marketing it and working with distributors to get it into record shops and into the iTunes music store and all that kind of stuff.
Almost trying to force the listeners closer to you so they can hear you.
Yeah, I mean, record labels are basically glorified marketing and distribution companies. That's what they do. Then typically what happens is, you know, is if you do well, then, the label... If it's a good label, the label will put the album in lots of stores, so lots of people buy it. And then when you sell a certain amount of copies, often a label will say, if you sell a certain amount of copies, we'll then give you tour support. So let's say you sell 30,000 copies in the US, we'll then send you on a tour, or we'll fund you to go on a tour with another band. Because if you want to go on tour with a big band, you typically have to pay. A lot of people don't realize this, that a lot of the support acts that you see when you go to see a main band, they actually pay to go on tour to do that, and it can cost. Like a friend of mine was in a band, and he went on tour with a band called Slayer, and I think they paid $100,000 to do that for a 36-day tour. So it's pretty expensive. So the challenge has been is that what's happened is the music industry has basically has been a victim of the economic downturn. So it means that in some cases with many labels, more bands are being signed, but less marketing is going into them. Mm-hmm. We've seen the same thing in publishing. I'm sure you're familiar with this, Randall, with publishing.
Absolutely.
Is that some publishers, they will only sign a few books. Like O'Reilly are good about this. They'll sign a few books, but then they'll do a decent job marketing them. And then some other publishers, who shall not be named, will take on hundreds and hundreds of authors, but provide barely any marketing, but lots of royalties. And then, but because it doesn't sell any books, you don't get any royalties. So
I've had books in both kinds of publishers. And if people look at my bibliography, you can kind of see what I'm talking about.
It's the same with me. I mean, it's a bit of a mug's game unless you know what you're doing. So what's happened with the record industry is bands, the idea of being signed to a record label is incredibly exciting for a band. So people get wooed by the romance of it. So they sign to a label, and then what they do is they sign their distribution rights to the label. The label doesn't have a lot of money to market it. So what happens is barely anyone gets to consume the product. So, you sign to a label. Many labels don't actually put your album in record stores. Some put them in limited record stores that not a lot of people go to. Not necessarily like big stores like Tower Records. So what happens is you don't really sell any albums, which means that you don't get tour support, and which means that you don't get to go on tour, which is what bands want to do. And that's where bands make money, because bands make money from selling merchandise and ticket sales.
And it's also because it's not getting in a lot of stores, it's not getting a lot of purchasing, which means it doesn't end up on, top 100 albums, so even radio stations aren't playing it.
Exactly. I mean, the problem is that you basically sign the promotional and distribution rights essentially over to a label. And what happens at that point is if the label doesn't do a very good job, then it really screws you up. If the label does a brilliant job, then you're fantastic. I mean, if the label puts loads of marketing money into it, ads and magazines, all the rest of it, then you're home and dry.
Yeah, but and there's also a conflict of interest on the label's part, which is that they're trying to control the distribution because they want to make money off of selling copies of hard copy bits. But they also want it to be heard everywhere. But, of course, that's a conflict because, if you just gave it away for free at that level, you're giving away the only way the label has of making money, which is selling these plastic round things.
Exactly. So I mean, this is the problem that we've got with the music industry. Mm-hmm. So Severed Fifth is I believe that we can solve this in a really elegant way. I believe that the answer isn't necessarily bands like Nine Inch Nails and Radiohead doing this. I mean, that's great that they do that, but what we need is a groundswell of smaller bands getting out there and doing this to encourage other bands to do it. Mm-hmm. And the same thing happened with software. The same thing happened with open source. Back in the 80s and the 90s, when we started seeing these case studies, like Linux is a great example. When companies and projects started hearing about Linux, like, oh my God, if they can do that, then we should do that.
Mm-hmm.
So you started seeing the shareware thing going away, more people working on free software and open source. And then that became a groundswell of interest that then brought the bigger companies taking interest in it. And now we've got the industry that we've got today, which is much more balanced. The thing, the same thing can happen with music. My goal with Severed Fifth is that Severed Fifth is that example. Mm-hmm. Is that, you know, I've been working in communities, you know, for a while now. So my goal is to basically take my background and experience of building community and my interest in music and to fuse the two together. So Severed Fifth becomes a really good example of a band that's been successful doing it with the, you know, the free culture way of doing things.
Well, just being a devil's advocate here for a second, because I want to see if you've addressed this.
Yeah.
I'm going to argue that Linux really didn't take off until Red Hat found a way to make money with it.
Oh, I'd say yes and no.
Okay.
It depends on what you define by takeoff. So if you're talking about huge corporate success, mm-hmm. then I'd agree. Companies really started considering Linux when Red Hat started putting their name behind it and making it a viable option.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of smaller projects, just being able to make software together and enjoy collaborating together and getting some success with their software, you know, projects like Inkscape or even things like Firefox at the beginning,
right.
And, you know, those kinds of projects, then it didn't really need Red Hat per se. It just needed the environment to be one in which success could be driven by open source software.
Well, and also, I'd also argue, though, that the fact that Red Hat was able to stand behind Linux gave a halo effect to a lot of these other projects, though.
Oh, yeah. I mean, totally. I mean, absolutely. And, you know, it all basically helps. So what I'm talking about here in many ways is there's two elements to consider in this change in the music industry. Mm-hmm. One is the opportunity surrounding the bands, and one is the opportunity surrounding the industry.
Mm-hmm.
The problem right now is that the industry, I think, benefits in the sense that the labels are the people who reap the financial rewards in many cases if they're willing to put the chips on the table and to invest in the bands. The problem that we've got right now is, again, the same kind of problem that we had with publishing. If you remember back, let's say, probably 15 years ago, if you wanted to be a writer, the only way you could be successful, really, is if someone gave you a break in a magazine or in a newspaper or with a publisher with a book.
Absolutely.
There was no blogging. There was no online writing. There was a very small group of people compared to the number of writers who made the decisions about editorially what was acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
Blogging changed all of that. And now some of the best writers in the world are writing them on their own blogs. And they got into writing for newspapers and magazines via success via their blogs. The same thing's happening with music. Is that, I mean, in my 15 years of playing in bands, I've played with hundreds of bands. Like anybody else who's played in bands for that long, it's nothing special to me. But I've been playing with hundreds of bands, and some of them are just absolutely unbelievable. I mean, these people blow some of the commercial artists out of the water,
mm-hmm.
but they never get noticed because the way in which success is decided on in the record industry is that you get signed. What I want to do is I want the same thing to happen to music that happened to blogging, which is bands that are really good at what they do get success because the common culture is that you give your content away, you spread the content around, and then fans engage with your band and support it in other ways. So I think there's an opportunity for bands for us to see better content, because bands will if we have a more open sourcey way of doing things in the music industry, we'll see better content in the same way that if you compare the shareware world with the open source world, you know, I think we'd all agree that open source is a lot better than most shareware.
Sure.
Because all that quality got to bubble to the surface. But also, in the same way in open source, we've seen companies like Red Hat and Novell and Canonical and various other companies thrive. I think that we can see the same thing in the music industry. There's still a huge amount of product opportunity surrounding bands. In the same way that there's a huge amount of product opportunity surrounding free software as well.
Well, I'm just curious about that, though. But one of the differences is that, you know, I'm a consumer of music. I'm not a co-producer. And so in this, I don't see exactly the similarity between this and, say, an open source software project where I can be both a consumer and a contributor. Is it just because I'm not a musician, so I don't see the angle to that? Or are you really just trying to talk about something like Severed Fifth putting out product and having other associated services be where the money flow actually happens?
I think it can happen in both ways. So, for example, you're a consumer of music in the same way that my mom is a consumer of software.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my mom doesn't contribute to any software whatsoever, but she is empowered by the choice that she's got available to her.
Sure.
So in terms of the collaboration angle, I think the element is that in the software world, one of the great things that open source brought to us was making it clear how people can collaborate around software that was traditionally done by just three or four people.
Mm-hmm.
And you could apply the same analogy to music. Three or four people are in a band, and they make the music. So this is a good example of one thing that we're trying to change with Severed Fifth. Is Severed Fifth is not just a band, but it's a community. It's a collaborative community. So, you know, yeah, we write the music, we perform the music, we record the music, we put it out there. But there are so many other things that people can do to participate in Severed Fifth. So as an example, there's a guy called Rob Keelty who loves the band, loves the music. He's an Android programmer. So he's created an Android Severed Fifth app. So when we're doing a show, I'll tweet where we are. Let's say we're hanging out in a bar down the road from the show.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tweet from that. And then if you're running the Severed Fifth app, a little notification pops up on your phone and it tells you where we are so you can come and hang out with the band. You know, we've got a guy who's working on a Severed Fifth fanzine. We've had a guy called Toronto Mario who's done probably about 50 Severed Fifth wallpapers. Some people have done some mobile wallpapers. You know, we've had some people working on a Frets on Fire game. So there's all these kinds of like collaborative elements that are not necessarily specifically the music. You know, one thing I'd like to do in the future is I'd like to have a competition whereby people can make videos for Severed Fifth songs.
Mm.
You know, all that kind of stuff, I think, shows the potential for people collaborating in a community in which the content is actually built by that small group of people.
Now, are you also envisioning people taking like your raw tracks and doing mix-ups on them, mashups?
Yeah, absolutely. So the actual songs are licensed as Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike. But one thing that I'd like to do is I'd like to get the original instrument tracks out so people can use them and they can remix them. The reason why we haven't done that so far is because we want to re-record our demo as a full album.
Mm-hmm.
And that leads me on to neatly into something we've called in the Severed Fifth recording campaign. So this is basically what happened is we recorded. So basically there's the demo that we put out there is called Nightmares by Design. If you go to severedfifth.com/releases, you can check it out. I know you've been having a quick listen to it today.
Indeed.
Randall. And it's, you know, it's, I recorded it in my home studio. I recorded it in the room I'm sat in right now. I did bass, the drums, Jim, our guitarist, came and did some solos, but I recorded everything because the other guys had just joined the band and they were still learning all the content.
Well, speaking of that, why don't we play one of the cuts from that? What cut would you like me to play?
Why don't we have a look at, let's put on Political.
Okay, Political, and why don't we set it up a little bit? What's the song about, if there even means anything in metal?
Oh, everything's written about something. So Political is basically it's a song about somebody who goes to the voting booth and they realize that they don't want to vote for anybody who's on the paper. It's just written about people who are dissatisfied with politics in general and the bickering and the nonsense and, you know, and the insanity that is the American political system.
I think you're describing 60% or 70% of the political voters today. That's pretty appropriate. And given that it's right around voting season here, it's really appropriate there. So let's go ahead and take a listen to that cut.
We'll be right back.
Okay, that was cool. That was nice. I got to say, I'm not quite a fan of metal, but I actually found that listenable. So
good,
if that's probably about the highest praise I can make for a metal song. Now, you said this is one of the songs you want to take forward through your recording campaign. And how was this recorded then, and what was missing in it?
Okay, so basically what happened is I recorded the album in this room, and we put it out there. And, people have been enjoying it. People have been downloading it. People have been putting it on their YouTube videos, which has been great. So we sat down with, we have a series of advisors who, we're very fortunate in the sense that we know a bunch of people who've been through the industry. They've played in some pretty big bands. The area that I live in, the Bay Area, is just wonderful for metal. So a lot of my favorite bands actually, they're based locally. So we know a lot of people who've been through the industry. And people who really like the idea of what we're doing in Severed Fifth, in terms of the new music economy and the music that we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
We sat down with one of these guys, and he said, can I take you for a beer? I was like, okay, slightly ominous.
Mm-hmm.
We all went out after rehearsal, and he said, look, he said, I love you guys. I love the music that you're doing. He said, I think they're great tunes. You have a great unity in the band. Like, the four of you are a great unit. And there's a great opportunity here, and I think you've got a real shot at making this happen. But I got to be honest with you. You got a great sounding demo, but not necessarily a great sounding album. He said, what you did with the resources that you've got is wonderful. He said, but you need to have that big, rich drum sound in there. You need to have the big thumping bass sound. You need to have it mixed by someone who's mixed metal bands before.
Mm-hmm.
You need to have a recording engineer when you're doing your vocals who's going to say, do it again until you get the best possible performance. And he was like, he said, again, what you've got right now, given the resources he had, is excellent. He said, but if you were to get in the studio and record this professionally, he said, it'll do the music justice.
So how was this recorded if it wasn't in a studio? Because it sounded kind of studio-ish to me, but that's because I'm not paying attention to the things you're talking about right now.
Yeah, I mean, I basically built a home studio in my house.
Okay.
So it's a PC with a Firewire recording surface. I'm using Cubase and a bunch of virtual instruments in terms, like, for example, I play the drums myself physically, but I actually map what I play on my drum kit to pre-recorded sounds. It sounds like a professionally recorded kit, but it still doesn't sound like an actual kit that's been recorded in a specific.
So those noises are all synthetic based on like a MIDI track or something that you would play.
So what I do is when I play the drums, I've got an electronic kit, but I play it like a normal drum kit. So mm-hmm. everything you hear in the album is me playing. But what happens is when I hit, for example, the snare pad,
mm-hmm.
it actually triggers a pre-recorded snare drum sound. So whenever I hit the drum, it basically plays the pre-recorded sound,
mm-hmm.
Which is good, but you don't get things like the sound of the room and the sound of the different drums resonating with each other and things like that. And that's what you get with a professional recording. I recorded all the guitars in here. I recorded all the bass, did the vocals myself. And I mixed it myself. And in fact, Dan on the show, Dan mastered it.
Dan Lynch, for those of us following along. Okay.
Yeah. So it's very much of a homebrew recording. And like this guy said, you need to have somebody who's pushing you. You need to have somebody who's going to say, who's a independent set of ears, who's going to say, you know what, that was a good take, but do it again.
And I just want to point out though that what you did with this cut already is something that maybe 15 years ago would have been impossible.
Oh yeah. I mean, I wanted to do this when I first got into music, when I was 16, I first started playing in a metal band. I wanted to do this. I started hearing about people using their computers to record on, because back then it was all tape.
Mm-hmm.
But now you can do it. I mean, the studio setup that I've got here cost me about $4,000. I mean, it's not a huge amount of money. And it's a pretty comprehensive setup. So, So basically we had that conversation with him, and, he gave us that frank and honest feedback, but it was nice that his feedback, even though he felt like the demo wasn't really cutting it, he said, the reason why is because he really believes the music is so strong. So we tuned it for a little while. We talked to some other advisors to the band, talked to our friends and family, And we were like, you know what? If we're going to do this right, if we're going to go out there and change how the industry works, then we need a professional recording. It needs to stand up to the newest Iron Maiden, the newest Megadeth, the newest Slayer album. It needs to be, you know, the kind of quality that you'd hear in the radio, and you wouldn't think, oh, that's a band that gives their music away for free.
Right, right. It should blend in with everybody else. Yes.
Yeah, in the same way that for Linux to compete, it needs to compete with the other operating systems in the world. So I started doing some digging around to see how much it was going to cost. It's going to cost about $5,000. No, we don't have $5,000 knocking around. So what I've done is I kicked out a 75th recording campaign. And the basic premise is we're asking our community that's formed around the band already to contribute to contribute what they can to help record the album. So, you know, I kicked this off, last week, towards the end of last week, and earlier last week. And, you know, people can just go to 75th.com/pay, and they can pay with PayPal, just with a credit card. And we've got some incentives, you know. So basically everybody who contributes, they get their name in the album liner notes. And, you know, when we release it, for people who contribute $50 or more, we send them a signed CD. A signed photo of the band and a CD copy of the demo that we've got already. Mm-hmm. You know, so we've had like four or five people contribute $50 or more. For people who contribute $100, we'll send them a limited edition T-shirt and the photo and the CD. $200, you know, we'll put their name in the actual new album and send them a numbered copy. And for $300, we'll dedicate a song to them at a show. So these are kind of incentives to help people to do this. So the way I've been presenting this is, you know, if you believe that the idea of 75th and what we're trying to do here in terms of trying to inspire change in the music industry, which is, you know, into a free culture way of doing things. And, you know, if you can support us, then that's great, because it's only 500 people to sponsor $10 and we're already there. So that's basically the plan.
Now this seems a little like, well, it's a bootstrapping step, I presume, because hopefully you'd have enough income from the professional cut then to hopefully bankroll the next album you want to do professionally again. Is this kind of a plan going to have to be repeated by every band that wants to do this?
Well, that's part of the experiment. I think it depends on what you want to do. So I think that for us to see if the experiment's going to work, we need to bankroll it in this way. Mm-hmm. But there's no reason why bands couldn't do this in the future as well. So, you know, so you get out there. The way I imagine it's going to work for bands is, you know, you do what we did. You record a demo and you put it out there and you play a load of shows and people start enjoying your music. And then people start contributing for you to go out there and record an album. And you know, the money that people contribute might not necessarily cover everything, but it might cover, you know, two or three days of recording time. And then you go out there, and then with that release, that then opens up further opportunities for you to play more shows and to sell more t-shirts at shows and to take some ticket sales, which then generates revenue that you can then invest in further recordings. So it is very much I think a lot of this is teaching bands how to be smart with money as well, is, you know, making sure that you invest what small resources you do have wisely into things. So, for example, the first thing I spent money on was T-shirts, because if I buy a stack of T-shirts and they're $3 or $4 a T-shirt, then we can sell them for $10. That brings in $5 or $6 a T-shirt. And, you know, it doesn't take long before you've paid off the lion's share of the T-shirts, and then you're into pure profit, which you can then invest in other things, such as buying banners for behind the stage and gas and stuff like that. So
the idea is that this is duplicable by pretty much any band that actually, you know, has a good sound and wants to get out there. How much of this is easily accessible in terms of documentation, in terms of your process?
So right now, people who are keeping up with the project, I'm writing a lot about what we're doing. The way I'd like to see it happen is 75th becomes successful and we start seeing this change happening. Mm-hmm. And then when that starts happening, I'm going to write a book. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to give the book away for free that basically explains how all of this worked. So it will become a manual for how a band can do exactly the same thing. So I'm making a load of notes while this is all going on that will go into that book.
And it's probably just as important for us to know not only what you did right, but also what you did wrong. What's the biggest thing you've done wrong so far?
Oh, totally. I mean, I think the biggest thing I've done wrong so far was when I kicked it off in 2008, you know, and then I released the first album, Denied by Rain, in 2008, and I thought, yeah, I can write a book at the same time. You know, that's when I got the deal for The Art of Community. Yeah, I can move countries at the same time. I can get married at the same time. I've discovered that if you don't put enough time into this, then you won't be successful. I mean, just having the online presence. I mean, as an example, you know, we've got facebook.com/severedfifth. We've got twitter.com/severedfifth. Identica.com/severedfifth. Mm-hmm. We've got reverbnation.com/severedfifth. youtube.com/severedfifth. You know, maintaining all of these sites, making sure that all of your shows are on all of these sites is one such example. Having an email address, having a website, putting all the photos up on there. You know, just maintaining an online presence in itself is a pretty significant amount of work. Making sure that you can get flyers done for your shows. Just rehearsing. I mean, we rehearse 3 times a week. It's a lot of work to do a band and to try and do it right.
So like everything else, what you're saying is you look like you could kind of mix it in with everything else you're doing, but time-wise, it's just really required a much bigger commitment than you thought you had.
Yeah, and, you know, at first I just didn't – I've been in bands before, but I didn't realize – you know, for me it's like this is my major project. I've never felt – I've not felt so excited and such an opportunity about change since I got into open source. When I first heard about open source when I was 17, back in 1997, 1998, when I first heard about that, I just thought, this is the way it's going to work. And that just got me completely obsessed about it. And I feel the same way about this. So, you know, but it needs time. So I think that was definitely the biggest mistake that I made. I mean, there's lots of little things like, you know, just lots of little things that I should have done. Like I should have got on MySpace earlier. You know, I should have identified some areas of growth, before I did. I should have got on YouTube earlier because video is a big attraction for a lot of people.
Yeah, obviously MySpace today is not as relevant as it was a couple of years ago.
Well, it's bizarre. I mean, it isn't as relevant, but it's still huge for bands.
Really?
Yeah, a lot of people used to use MySpace as Facebook. You know, for having their own profile. Mm-hmm. Everyone uses Facebook for that now, but there's still a huge amount of bands on MySpace. I mean, we use Facebook a lot as well. But you know, all those social networks are really, really useful ways of helping to pull people in and get people excited.
The name Severed Fifth, I got to ask, where'd that come from?
I don't know. it was,
who do we ask then?
Well, I was trying to think of a name for a band. I mean, you know, my last band when I was in England before I moved over here was called Seraphidian. And, you know, it's a completely fictional word that was from Seraph, which is the order of angels, and Ophidian, which is the order of snakes. And we put it together, and it sounded pretty metal.
Yes.
And I wanted a term that was invented. I didn't want it to be called, you know, kill or something.
Yes.
Know? Or, you know, brutal or something. So I just had this vision in my head of someone tearing the Fifth Amendment in half. So that's where the term Severed Fifth came from. But people have like interpreted it in lots of different ways. And a lot of people seem to get it wrong and say that we're Severed Filth, which is not the case. In fact, we had that printed on, we did a show on Saturday, and we had that printed on the ticket with Severed Filth. So,
wow. Crazy. And I also, where I went is something about a fifth interval. But
yeah, a lot of people have thought that as well. The fifth interval in music.
So it just doesn't have any meaning. It's just the name.
It's just a name, yeah. You know, it's pretty easy to say, and it's pretty understandable. And people, I like the fact that people can interpret it in their own way as well, which is cool.
Great. It's like any good art form, which is like, you know, the interpretation's half the deal there. Yeah.
Mm.
And yeah. You resisted putting a heavy metal umlaut in there, though.
No heavy metal umlaut. No. Motley Crue have already done that.
And a Death Tongue and a whole bunch of other ones, yes.
Yeah.
Spinal Tap. All those. Good. Well, speaking of which, let's go ahead and pull another cut from your latest album, your demo. Again, this is the demo. This isn't the stuff you want to do eventually. What other cut would you like the audience to listen to?
So why don't we put in... Foretold Revelation, which is the opening track of the album, of the demo. This is a song. I have an obsession with Wikipedia. I read about all kinds of stuff on Wikipedia. And around the time that I wrote this, I was reading all about Egyptology and you know, Egyptian gods and all that kind of stuff and the mythology there. And this song is written about the god of a god called Thoth. I was just reading about it on Wikipedia and kind of like some supernatural Egyptian battle. So yeah, it's pretty Eastern sounding.
Cool,
which is fun.
Looking forward to it. Here we go.
Thank you.
Wow. Okay. That was a good one. Nice one. I got to say, as you were talking before the song about Thoth, that ironically, that was a coincidence, is that that was the name that Tom Christensen used whenever he was on IRC.
So, oh, really?
Yeah. So the big pro guy, my fellow Perl trainer, Tom Christensen, and fellow author. So it's like, hey, well, there's a nice overlap there in the open source community. And you probably didn't know that.
There we go. A mine of fascinating facts.
Trivia. That's all I'm good for is trivia.
Randall Schwartz.
So this is fascinating stuff. I'm looking at this from the perspective of, you know, your experience and exposure in the open source community has led you to observe a number of things that work and don't work about open source. And it's interesting that you're taking some of that knowledge and applying it to the music industry. Are there more lessons in open source, or is there any lessons to bring back yet from this back to the open source community?
Good question. I don't know. I mean, there's one thing I've definitely learned is different communities are very, very, like, different communities, as in, you know, whether it's music or software or writing or whatever it is, they are very different culturally. Mm-hmm. Like the cultural norms inside the music world and the cultural norms inside the open source world are radically different. I think there's a because open source is very much it's a very empowered community. It's a community that always seeks to have the content and the tools to be able to make things, even if they don't actually need to or want them. You don't have that so much in the music world. So, you know, for example, in the open source world, you can talk about a project that you've been working on, and instead of somebody saying, "Hey, that's really cool," you know, "that's really interesting what you're doing," the first thing they'll say is, "Where's the source code?"
Yeah.
Because it's a wonderfully empowered community that's by definition collaborative. In the music world, a lot of people won't necessarily say, "Where's the music? Give it to me for free," because it's a world that is so familiar with the idea of, yeah, you know, I look forward to buying your new album when it's in shops. You know, and I think that's going to change a lot in the music world. I think people should expect to get the content when they want it. So the kind of just the way in which people, just even just the language, I mean, you know, the way that people chat to each other, it's much more in open source. It's a little bit more formal and a little bit more I wouldn't say subdued, but a little bit more what's the word I'm looking for? You know, people talk to each other a little bit, in some cases, a little bit more like their colleagues. In the metal world, everyone says, you know, everyone refers to each other as bro, and, you know, "Hey man, how's it going? Good to see you, bro," all this kind of stuff. You know, it's a very, very, the metal world and the music world particularly, it's like a big family. And, you know, some people do have differences of opinion when it comes to different bands, but everyone considers themselves in the same family. In the open source world, you know, those people, some people see non-free software as immoral and some people don't. So that's, you know, that's a diametric difference, for example, in terms of how people view the wider community. So.
Now, some aspects of it as well. I mean, another thing I see different about the music community as opposed to, say, the open source community is that I can feel that I'm on, I can have a personal relationship with even people like Richard Stallman or Linus because he's got an email address and I can interact with him. I think in the music community, and correct me if I'm wrong about this, but it's more of a people up on pedestals over there generating this content that I really enjoy, and that makes them like almost unapproachable in that sense. Are you finding that maybe something like Severed Fifth is breaking those barriers down some more?
I think to a degree. I mean, it depends on the music. I mean, if you're talking about, you know, huge artists like Britney Spears and, you know, rest in peace, Michael Jackson, and, you know, U2 and bands like that. Mm-hmm. I think that's definitely the case. A lot of music consumers who are not massively into music, they just listen to it, you know, when they can, think that the music world is like that. But for example, in the metal world and certainly in other genres such as hip hop and country and western music and grass hop and all that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. there is lots of access, you know. So, you know, a lot of the metal bands that I listen to in my world, you know, I can contact them. I can chat to the artists in many cases on Facebook or over email and things like that. It's not really any different.
Part of that's probably because now with the prevalence of social media and everybody having, you know, Twitter handles and Facebook accounts, that this is really sort of the place to be for bands that want to have any kind of a following. I mean, if you're completely away from all that, you're not going to have the kind of following and social sharing that needs to happen to really make you big now.
Yeah, I mean, I think some bands are still definitely behind the curve when it comes to that. I mean, it amazes me that some bands are so behind the times. And I think 7/5 will help a lot with that because, you know, we've made social media, much as I hate the term social media, you know, it you know, we do use it a lot and we do want to make the band as accessible as possible and as encouraging as possible. And welcoming people into the 7/5 family. So, you know, I think it will definitely help. I mean, while the new music economy kind of side of 7/5 is probably the most, you know, revolutionary aspect of it, I think the getting people used to being accessible and communicating in all these different mediums, I think will definitely encourage a lot of bands as well.
Now, you're not just about recording, you're doing live shows too, right?
Absolutely, yeah. We did our first live show a couple of months ago.
And how's that gone?
Really well. We've done three shows so far, and yeah, I mean, our first show was just mind blowing. We couldn't believe the response that we had. When you start gigging, I've done this before with other bands and the other guys have as well. You know, usually you go and play a show and you're up on the stage, you know, head banging and running around and getting all excited, and sometimes you'll have, you know, a row of people stood in front of you with their arms folded, waiting to be convinced. We did our first show in Livermore at a small club called Pine Street Sports Bar, and it's actually a pretty cool venue. And we did our first show, and we had, you know, 40-50 people came down to watch us play. We had no idea who most of these people were, and they were incredibly supportive. And then we did our second show at the same place. The first show that we did, the headlining band is a band called Falling to Pieces, and their singer is this chick called Nikki DeSoto, and she unfortunately passed away. She was killed in a motorbike accident. So we did a tribute show for her. We only met her once, but she was just a wonderful, wonderful performer. So we did our second show as a tribute for her, and then we played our third show on Saturday night in Modesto, and we had a really great night on Saturday. So
now, are you connected on those shows? Are you like live streaming them or anything?
No, not yet. I mean, a lot of these venues don't really have the capabilities to do that. A lot of them don't have internet access and things like that. It's hard enough. You know, I want to, you know, be Twittering and updating Facebook and whatever else from these venues, but it's hard enough doing that, let alone streaming content. And also sound engineers in a lot of these venues are pretty grumpy people. So, you know, that's just another thing for them to worry about.
They need to feed at exactly this level from the beginning of the show. No, yeah, right.
I think it'd be cool to do that.
Does a band like 7/5 then, or do they present themselves any differently to, let's say, a venue because you're doing this sort of open source work?
Not really. I mean, you know, so, for example, one thing I do is, you know, when we do a show, we have these little handouts that we give out. We put out on all the tables. We give some stickers out as well. And it says, you know, in big letters, we believe that music should be free. Mm. So people can see it right up front. But, you know, we don't really present ourselves very differently to venues. Because, frankly, right now, the venues, most of them would have no idea what the words open source or free culture mean.
Right.
So we believe that, you know, to be successful, you got to get out there and be musically successful, and then people hear that your music's free, and they're like, oh. I want people to like 7/5 not just because the music's free, but because the music's good, and they feel empowered by the fact that the music's free. So,
well, clearly that's the case, but it would be interesting if you could build in a bias for venues to want to have something like 7/5 as opposed to the traditional format band.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And one thing I'd like to see some festivals. Like a friend of mine, Mark Turanova, has been talking about, he'd love to do some kind of free culture, Creative Commons type festival. And I think that would be absolutely fantastic to have something like that. So I think we will get there, because what will happen, the way I think it's going to work, in fact, the way I know it's going to work, I'm pretty confident about this,
mm-hmm.
more confident than I should be. But the way I think it's going to work is that the bands who give their music away for free will have the bigger crowds. I mean, all venues care about when they put bands on, they just want to bring in people to buy drinks. You know, they make their money from ticket sales, which most of the ticket sales will go to the bands and the promoters. So they'll take a little bit cut off the door, but they make their money from drink sales and from food and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a band and you've got a big following, you're going to get the shows because you've got a decent following. And you get that by giving your music away.
Yeah. Do you think venues will believe like number of people subscribe to you on Facebook or Twitter as part of an indication of your size?
I think in some cases, yeah, because a lot of promoters use Facebook as a means to communicate with bands. So seeing success there is actually a good way of, I think, giving you a shot at a venue. And promoters, in many cases, promoters are pretty selfish people in a right way, because what they want is they want bands that they like as well. So, you know, promoters will put on bands that they think are cool. And if they can bring a crowd as well, then that makes them doubly exciting. So if you're a good band and you've got a decent following, you know, it's a great way of moving you forward.
So another way to actually help Severed Fifth out is to go and subscribe your Facebook page.
Oh, massively. So, I mean, you know, we talked about the Severed Fifth recording campaign. I mean, that's a great, you know, financially, that's a great way of supporting the band. And if people are interested in that, then you can go to severedfifth.com/pay.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can't afford to, or, you know, because the whole idea behind our fair pay system that we set up for Severed Fifth is you pay what's fair and affordable for you. So for some people, it will be, you know, $1. Mm-hmm. And for some people, it will be $50 based upon, your how much money you've got. So we don't feel like we should mandate how much you should pay us.
Mm-hmm.
That should be your choice and your decision. A friend of mine, he's been having some pretty tough times financially recently. He paid $1. That's a lot of money for him right now. And a friend of mine, he's doing really well, and he paid $50, and $50, you know, isn't a huge amount of money for him. It empowers your fans to pay what they feel like is fair. It lets them make up their own minds. But if you choose to not contribute financially, a great way of helping Severed Fifth is to follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/SeveredFifth. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/SeveredFifth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we also have a forum on the website. If you go to SeveredFifth.com, there's loads of photos and music that you can download for free, and there's videos on there and stuff like that. And you can there's a forum on there. So SeveredFifth.com/forum. You can participate in the community. We've got a street team where people work together on flyers and getting out there and spreading the word, all that kind of stuff. So
you still have a day job. You're still working for
Canonical.
You know, yeah. Canonical, yeah. Do you foresee sometime in the future when this will be your full-time gig?
No, I don't see that. I mean, I'd be surprised if that happens. I mean, a lot of people ask me that.
Like I just did.
Yeah, yeah. Like a lot of metal bands, a lot of bands that you'd see doing tours and doing shows, they don't do it as their full-time job. A lot of acts that you'll hear about, on TV and on radio and stuff like that, then it's not their full-time job. They have a normal job, but they do their music in their spare time, and then they take time off work to go on tour. So I don't foresee this really changing in the future for us. I mean, I'd like to see us have success, but even if Severed Fifth was to become my day job, you know, I'd be doing that during the day, and I'd be spending the evenings working on Ubuntu. So,
so it wouldn't matter either way.
Yeah, they'll always be both, because I'm really passionate about both.
This is really an amazing project you've taken on, and I really appreciate you being articulate about it and explaining it to me in ways that I had no clue about before we started this interview. So,
thanks, Randall, for letting me come on and talk about it. I know it's one of the challenges with it is it's. There's a lot of detail, and the detail connects in different ways, and so I can understand people saying, what the hell is he talking about? But I appreciate you having given me the time.
Open source music, what the hell's that about? Yeah. And now we know. That's very, very good. So again, find out more at severedfifth.com, right?
severedfifth.com, yeah.
Very good. Well, thanks so much for coming on, John. I really appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Thanks, Randall.
And that was John O'Bacon and his project. You can go to severedfifth.com and find out all sorts of things from there. I really encourage you, if you're into music or into open source or into a combination of the two, please check the project out, see what way you can participate, and at least spread the word, let people know that we have this sort of thing available to us, and let it be a good model for how music can be generated in the future. Speaking of the future, we have a whole bunch of new guests on the schedule. I finished out my first quarter of 2011 openings, and so I have a number of new people to talk about today. Coming up next episode, which will be 2 weeks from now because I'll still be taking another break here, is Mark Laporte, not related to Leo Laporte, talking about Tiki Wiki, which is a content management system that started as a wiki, and then, as always, it grew and grew until it became a very classy and comprehensive groupware application. And the rescheduled show of David Ankers and James Cotton talking about OpenPilot, the OpenPilot software and hardware solutions to have UAVs be driven by open source. A lot of fun. Saw some video on that. Really looking forward to that one. Just added to the schedule, John Hugg is going to talk to us about VaultDB, which is a SQL, traditional SQL database, but designed from the ground up to be as fast as or faster than the NoSQL solutions that we have been talking about. Some really remarkable things going on with that, so I'm looking forward to bringing you yet another tack on how to store big data and how to get to it fast. John Weigley, John Weigley, something like that, is going to talk to us about the Ledger Accounting System, which is a full accounting bookkeeping system, all open source. A lot of people have told me, yes, we're actually using that in our business or using it for my personal finances, so looking forward to that. Jeremy Carbow is going to come to us talking to us about Sunlight Labs, which is a project to bring more open source and transparency to government. Boy, would that be appropriate this time of year with all the recent activity in the news. Following that, Ludovic Marcotti. Oh man, that's another name I'm going to mispronounce, but we'll do it anyway. He's going to talk to us about Packet Fence, which is a firewall setup, a captive portal setup for Wi-Fi, and SOGO, which I forgot to research. So both of those projects. Michael Yap is going to bring us some information about Joget, J-O-G-E-T. Another one of those platforms for creating very rich web applications running mostly in the browser. Looking forward to that. Mostly based on workflow, I understand. And then bringing back, because we had to reschedule him, we've got Darren Schreiber of the 2600 Hertz Project, which is about all sorts of open source aspects to telephony. Looking forward to that. And finally, not really a colleague of mine, but I've bumped into him a couple times, Gilad Braca is going to talk to us about Newspeak, which is a follow-on to the Smalltalk language. He'll probably get mad at me for describing it that way, but really sort of taking a look at modern aspects of security and privacy and modularization with Smalltalk in a whole new language. Gotten a lot of buzz on the net when he first started talking about it a year or two ago, so I want to have him come on and talk about language development in the modern age. Lots and lots of good stuff. More stuff on the shortlist, twit.tv/floss, to see the spreadsheet, to see what other shows I'm trying to bring in. Lots and lots of people to bring in for a second quarter right after that. Loving the show. Loving your comments coming back. You can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/Merlin, M-E-R-L-Y-N. And probably right about now, I also have an audio piece in the latest starshipsofa.com. I'm reading science fiction pieces, narrating them for the science fiction podcast. Really liking that. I'm also probably going on 3 more cruises in the first quarter, including the Joko Crazy. I'm going out to hang out with Jonathan Colton coming up in a couple weeks, which will be a lot of fun. Jonathan Colton, John Hodgman, Will Wheaton, Paul and Storm. I think you might even still be able to get a slot on that if you go there now, like right now, and plan your trip to Florida within the next 2 weeks. If not, that's okay too. I'll probably have something to report on that when I come back. That also to find out about those cruises, insightcruises.com. And in conclusion, after right now I've plugged everything I want to plug, I want to say thank you for being a listener to the show. And wherever you are, and whatever holiday you happen to be celebrating, happy holidays. I presume this is a holiday season for most of us. I know it is for me. I'm just finished American Thanksgiving, and I'm working my way towards American Christmas right about now. So happy holidays to everyone. We'll see you next time on Floss Weekly.